Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It's Monday, February 27th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. As always, I want to start the show by thanking those of you who have supported it throughout the last week. I have named the levels on my Patreon page, so I'm going to go through them in order. The coolest person in the solar system this week goes to Mark Hepburn, Phil T-Bear, and Timothy Glover. Okay, the coolest people in the solar system. The coolest people on Earth go to Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Christian Jeffrey, David Lacer, Jeffrey Perez, Stuart Ogg, The Honorable Husband, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. And of course, if you want to be the coolest person in the universe, all you have to do is visit www.patreon.com/talknerdy. I also want to thank Horatio Tovar, who visited my website, carasantamaria.com, and clicked through to show a generous support of the show using the PayPal portal. There's a lot to do on the site. Make sure you give it a visit. Okay, I'm really excited about this week's guest. He is a professor of information studies and design at UCLA, and he just wrote a great book. It's actually available very soon. It's called Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. If you go to Amazon right now, you can pre-order it if you're listening to it before, or if you're listening to this podcast before it's completely available. So without any further ado, may I introduce to you Dr. Ramesh Srinivasan. Well, Ramesh, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm excited to be here, Kara.
Yeah, it's so fun to do these talks in person in studio. I feel like there's a different energy that you get from it. Plus, we get to have a nice cup of tea.
Lovely Earl Grey here on a lovely afternoon.
Really? It's surprisingly warmer than it, like, it says it's pretty cold outside. Cold for LA is like 60, so sure. I apologize to anybody listening who's like seeing snow out their window. But the sun is very hot today.
It's great. I was playing tennis earlier and I was loving it. Oh. I was loving it. I was getting baked in the sun.
What a nice Friday.
Oh yeah.
So you have an interesting kind of schedule and sort of your attentions are in different places because you're a professor and professors always, I feel like even though professors generally have a staff position at a university, whether you're faculty or whether you're, you know, tenured or not, there's a vibe of a freelancer's lifestyle to a professor, isn't there?
Yeah, we're really free agents on some level. I mean, we are connected to our universities. We care deeply about our students. I love teaching, but my work, like my intellectual work and definitely my publicly engaged work, is really just connected to me and who I am and what I believe in. And so that's a different community. That's a community that includes people like yourself, right? Mm. And that's sort of distinct from the like standard kind of institutional affiliation that we sometimes have.
Yeah, I like that you voice that you love to teach. I do find that I'm always the most interested in people who are really passionate about teaching, and it bumps me out when I meet professors who kind of see that as a, I don't know, like an annoying part of their job that they just have to do, because it's so meaningful to have a new generation of students who are engaged with you, who maybe aren't lucky enough to be in your, in science, there are always labs. What do you call it? Like in your office?
We have like, you know, it's a workshop or it's a lab in a very different way. It's sort of an experimental, playful space in lots of ways. And I love teaching because I learn a great deal about myself as I teach, and I learn a great deal from my students. And I'm not just a trite phrase. It's actually the ways in which my students sort of see the world and these questions that we look at about the relationship between the internet and our world. For my students to share their insights with me is profound because so many of them grew up with the internet, with my undergraduates.
Oh, you're right. They're all such, like when we use the term digital natives, they truly are digital natives. Like I'm 33, and I think I had my first computer in the classroom in third grade, but we were not connected to the internet until much later than that.
They grew up with the internet, so many of their tendencies and their mechanisms by which they experience the wider world take for granted the internet, and they're sort of seeing the internet shift in front of their eyes, and in some ways, they're getting concerned about that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of all they've ever known.
Right.
So you're a professor of, it's such an interesting title, of information studies and design at UCLA. Is that a title that, like, you kind of made up? Is there a whole department dedicated to that? What department are you in? It's an interesting kind of blending, I think, of two, what we think of as being, like, disparate disciplines.
Yeah, it's a really good question. Well, my background is partly as an engineer, partly as a designer, and partly as someone who's trained in fields like anthropology and cultural studies. And because of my design background, which is all about trying to think about how you design technology, it relates critically with the information studies side of things, because information studies is interested in the relationship between people and societies and cultures with information, or you could say with technology, right? Mm-hmm. So that these two connect because My purpose is in thinking about how we design and develop technologies to better support like grassroots human, cultural, and political values. And so I look at those questions all over the world, and that's where the anthropology side comes in.
I love that. That doesn't seem like a typical approach to engineering and design. It doesn't seem like most students who go to engineering school or who are studying, I don't know, material science or biomedical science, you know, or materials design often are lucky enough to get an education in that. What is your PhD actually?
My PhD is in design studies from Harvard University. But my committee was bringing together people from MIT and Harvard together, including computer scientists, designers, and philosophers.
So
I had
cool.
a committee that bridged these two universities. I did my master's at MIT. So that was part of the reason I was able to pull that group together. But yeah, this kind of super interdisciplinary background that I have is just me following my own heart. It's my own path. It was my realization that, you know, people create technology, right? And people within certain cultures create technology, just like humans create stone tools, or we create the wheel, or we create writing. So that means technology is open for human modification and human design.
So what department are you in at UCLA?
My main department's information studies. And then I have a what's called a joint appointment where I sit on crits, like art and design crits for the design department.
Oh, very cool. And so I guess just for my very kind of concrete scientific mind, when you say information studies, it sounds so broad. It sounds like I'm in the department of the things. You know what I mean? Like what is, so information really is, it's technology meets kind of the content of the internet.
So Gregory Bateson, the philosopher, once said, information is any difference that makes a difference, right? So like we all know that whether we're, you know, infants or whether we're full-grown adults, like I think we are, that we are always experiencing information. The question is what types of information make a difference in our life? And our experiences of information have increasingly shifted to our uses of digital platforms, right? So they are the platforms by which we experience so many phenomena about ourselves from like Fitbits to phenomena about our social networks through Facebook, to phenomena about news and the political climate through our online social media, you know, platforms and Google News and so on. So these are problematically at times, right?
So it's a lot of kind of what we think of as big data.
Absolutely. So big data, which is one of the big charges now for thinking about scientific communication as well, is, you know, again, the big challenge is how do we think about big data in socially meaningful ways? How do we think about like when we kind of do algorithmic practices to try to analyze and mine big data, what are the questions being answered? What are like counterfactuals? What other kinds of questions could have been answered? So yeah, it's the morass of information in digital form has expanded, revolutionized over the last 20 years, right?
There's so much we don't know what to do with it. There's so much we can't sort through it. And we're fundamentally, I think, unaware of how much of our own habits and practices and identification and personal information just really exists out there for whoever knows what to do with it to be able to do quite a lot with it.
And that's why our gatekeepers to the information universe, now Google and Facebook, I would say, each with about 1.8 billion users, right? And about 4 billion people in the world with some internet access at this point.
That's half the world.
Yes, a little over half. And then over half of that, or nearly half of that amount, are Facebook and Google users. And so we're not even thinking about the Chinese, which have a massive user base.
Yeah.
So that those platforms are so important because they make meaning, ostensibly, of the noise of information, right?
Yeah.
But the problem is we can't just simply trust them as neutral. We have to understand how they are filtering and structuring our digital and informational experiences.
Yeah, you know, we first met back when I was doing a show called Take Part Live, and I remember having a director and producer on named Cullen Hoback,
yeah,
who did a documentary called Terms and Conditions May Apply. And that's really kind of what the focus of his documentary was about, this trade-off between convenience and privacy. You know, this idea that, like, mm-hmm, we're often willing to allow a lot of our personal information out sort of into the ether because the more that, like, a Google or a Facebook knows about us, the more they can target things to us, and they can, and the user experience becomes really easy. It becomes very natural. The problem with that is that then you also have so much of your personal information out there, yeah, for anybody to use basically for free. And they monetize it, right? They make a lot of money off of it.
It's the oil of the digital economy, mm-hmm, right? Information is the oil of the digital economy. And Kevin Kelly, founding editor of Wired Magazine, once said in a TED Talk that he gave that total personalization is the way things are going to go. And, you know, what we mean by personalization, we need to, like, think about a little. And he said the only way you're going to get total personalization, meaning these platforms are going to know everything about you and tell you what you need to know, is through total transparency. So those are not sort of like simple, like, binary concepts. Mm-hmm. What transparency, what personalization mean? They mean different things to different people, both in terms of, like, political context, but also culturally.
Yeah. And, you know, there is, I think, this innate fear, or I should say protective mechanism, that I think a lot of the older generation have when it comes to privacy, when it comes to who I am, what you know about me. These are things that I hold dear to myself, and they're things that I'm not willing to give up without a certain amount of trust. Yet, and kind of correct me if I'm wrong, it seems that that doesn't exist so much in this digital native kind of millennial group, simply because it's never been an option for them.
Exactly. It's because a lot of younger people are habituated to just giving information and feeling like all this information is known about them. But then when I'm in my classes and I give them examples about, for example, data retention, like, what happens if you're caught smoking weed when you're 18 years old or younger, and then that's on your job application when you're 40, right? Like, that's problematic. Or data aggregation, right? Like, so, like, should my library, my library card data be combined with my data at the supermarket, or worse, right?
Mm-hmm. And what kind of, like, new things are we going to learn from cross-referencing that?
Cross-referencing.
Yeah, I just did 23andMe. A lot of people I know say that they don't want to do it because they don't feel comfortable with their genetic data existing somewhere in a database, right, even if it is anonymized.
Right.
And, oh, what just happened? It literally just happened last night. I've been corresponding with a Wikipedia editor who reached out because of a separate project that I did for the movie Hidden Figures. Mm-hmm. I did an app in combination with Ogilvy and the New York Times where I wrote pieces for each of these interesting 10 minorities in history who did a lot for science, and then I voiced them. And so you can go to the app, it's an augmented reality app, and you can hear my voice talking about these people, which is great. That's and cool. Part of their project was that they basically did a ton of deep dive research and were able to beef up all of the Wikipedia pages to go along with these individuals because they were really, in essence, quote, hidden figures. They didn't have very strong Wikipedia pages. So I'd mentioned this on air. This editor reached out to me and said, I want to know more about it. And I was like, oh, I don't know. Eventually, we found the information that he needed. And he looked through my Wikipedia page as part of it. And he was like, hey, I saw some quotes from this Joe Rogan interview you did years ago. And Rogan was talking about Monsanto and was saying they're like an evil corp and that they did this and there was like the suicides in India and blah, blah, blah. And you were like really agreeing with everything he said. And he was like, do you have any comment on that?
Right.
And I was like, oh, shit. Yeah. I was like, really? I was? That doesn't sound like me. But it was before my days of being in the SGU. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, yes, I was vehemently saying, no, GMOs are good. GMOs can help feed the world. But I wasn't like up to speed. I told him, like, I wasn't woke yet, you know?
Yeah, sure.
Like, I wasn't woke to the sure. Indian suicide sure. bullshit that was kind of made up by GMO activists. Mm-hmm. And he was like, well, you're on tape. And I'm like, mm-hmm. yeah, you know, we learn, we grow. But something like that to a politician could ruin their career.
Exactly. And so data trails about us are always being formed because even these devices that we use, like even if we have them on an airplane mode, as Edward Snowden's pointed out, they can gather data about us that are then backed up into the cloud in some sort of manner that is. And so the problem is it's all opaque, right? We don't have any understanding of like what's being gathered about us in what ways. And more importantly, we don't know how that could be used in a sort of political or surveillance-based context.
That's
moving
true.
Forward.
It doesn't even have to be a public conversation. It could be something that we think of as like really private and protected and not even data-driven. Like, I didn't record this phone conversation, yet if I said something near my phone, there's a chance that it could have been
right.
digitized.
And also, it's metadata that's being gathered, right? It's like, it's the where, when, mm-hmm. and, you know, and so, like, it's all the data about what you're doing, which is actually a really fundamental form of data. And that's
yeah.
sort of one of the things when the PRISM project, you know, kind of came to light, and also what GCHQ's done in England, there was this Obama said, you know, well, we aren't recording your phone calls. And it's like, but you're recording everything about what we do with those phone calls. So I think it's one of those moments right now that we're at where it's actually extremely interesting because we do have a president who is directly trying to oppose any of these ideas of any sort of factuality or any record being legitimate. And it's really interesting, like outside of like people being upset about that, I think it's a really interesting kind of philosophical and political moment that we need to come to reckoning with, which is why is the president of the United States able to get away with directly lying about so many issues and just saying, well, whatever, you know, those are alternative facts. And to me, the reason why is because this is the other thing that's going on with the internet. We are fragmenting, splintering, and being placed into bubbles. So his fans are going to see him get angry about these supposed factual errors or these factual issues and join his cause, right? They're, mm-hmm. Because they're going to be on their own walls, you know, in their own networks, and they're going to be in a hysterical, like not funny, but like with hysteria, they're going to be celebrating him. They're going to be like, it's like a martyr, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of us, or, you know, the other 60%, if you will, are going to be really upset about it and are going to be like, why can't he change? And the reason is because he doesn't have to.
Yeah,
he doesn't
because he
have
gets
to.
Enough, not just support, but kind of feedback that bolsters him.
It works.
I think. Yeah, it works. And it works very, very well. The real concern of mine is not so much that there are like two sides of the divide, because I do think there's, and I could be wrong, and this is, I think, probably going to be the topic of most of our conversation today. We talk about this a lot in the skeptical movement and kind of just the evidence-based thinking, science-based thinking movement, which is there is truth, or at least there's an attempt at reaching truth that is in certain situations more fallible than others. There are philosophical approaches towards truth. Many people who are big fans of science-based thinking really do think that a scientific approach to truth is sort of like the best thing we have, utilizing the scientific method and interrogating reality in that way.
Sure.
And there's always going to be a segment of the population who actually outright rejects reason and logic. Mm-hmm. And that segment kind of, it's not, I guess you could call it a knowledge deficit problem. It's not like just, oh, they haven't seen the facts, so the more facts I throw at them, no. It's usually motivated by something emotional, something irrational. Alienation, fear, yep. racism, religion,
sure.
abuse, you know, all of those different things. And yes, I think that segment we'll put them on the shelf for a second. And we'll really talk about people who kind of operate within a rational framework, regardless of what side of the aisle they're on, regardless of who they're getting their news from. Historically, have there not at least been some bastions of what we think of bipartisan, neutral reporting? Sure. That's what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid that this just happened this morning. It is Friday, February 24th, as we're recording this. And just this morning, Sean Spicer turned the New York Times, CNN, Politico. Who else was in that list? BuzzFeed.
I mean, they were all added to the list.
Yeah, yeah. Out of the White House press briefing. Yeah. It was basically, you guys aren't allowed to come.
It's a delegitimation of kind of more fact-based mainstream media.
Yeah, here it is. CNN, New York Times, LA Times, Politico, and BuzzFeed. But who could go? Fox News, Breitbart. I mean, and I do think we'll put Fox News on the shelf and we'll put CNN on the shelf. If we were to sit here as a neutral party, and of course people are going to say you're biased, you're in your own liberal bubble, you know, you're sure. academic, whatever, and put the New York Times next to Breitbart News, which one is more moderate? Which one is more fact-based? Which one sure. is more truth-seeking?
By any measure, of course, it's the New York Times. And those of us who are trained to kind of critically think about media don't give the New York Times a free pass. Mm-mm. But at the same time, we understand that those are very different ways of trying to analyze phenomena, recount phenomena, use observations to construct narratives. And of course, it's not as simple as that. It's also about how journalists choose to frame issues, how they're funded, all the like even manufacturing consent kind of stuff from Chomsky.
Yeah.
But
and how they're trained, you know, precisely. What their ethical kind of yeah. goals are. But yeah. like, I subscribe to the New York Times and the LA Times as my neutral papers. Yes. That's just where I go to find out what happened, not to get any sort of editorializing about it or opinion about it.
Sure.
I read other things for that. I might read some Slate or Salon or
Guardian.
Or The Guardian or The Atlantic if I want to get some more kind of opinion-based, more of my liberal bubble information.
Sure.
But I go to the New York Times and the LA Times, two of the ones that were blocked from the White House because they're neutral, or at
right.
least as close to neutral as I've assessed. And as I think, like you said, academics who focus on this have assessed are sort of the closest thing we have.
Well, what's happening is Facebook has become the gateway for people to experience news in the United States. And so about 70% of Americans have Facebook accounts, and 70% of those adults get their news on Facebook. So that's a massive number of people. That's about 50% of the overall American population, which far outnumbers New York Times, LA Times put together, right?
Yeah.
So what does that mean? That means we go to these familiar, supposedly safe places, but we know those places are curated by our existing social networks, and we know how hard it is to have conversations on Facebook with people we don't politically agree with. But it's also curated algorithmically in ways we have no understanding of. And Facebook is unwilling at this point to even kind of give us some heuristics into how that works.
It really is a black box.
And that's what I'm arguing for in my piece that's going to appear on CNN's website, for Facebook to just give us some pathways. I understand it's like corporate property. It's a competitive product. But Facebook is actually a media network now.
Yeah.
So media networks do owe us some public responsibility. So Breitbart, even though it may not be fact-based, and you're totally right, it's just a random punditry. I mean,
it's
obscene punditry,
yeah.
I would say, and full of hate, in my opinion, as well, I'll be honest. It works with Facebook as the mode of mediation of its narratives, right? So that's the key here. Like I look at these things in relation to other mechanisms by which information is delivered and shapes the American public. And then the other side of my work, just to share this, is, you know, in my book, Who's Global Village, it's all about not just our current American environment and breaking past these bubbles and these kind of opaque filters, but it's also about this hope that I have always had that we will continue to develop an internet that better respects the diverse ways in which people from different cultures kind of speak about and know their world. Like, I'll give you an example.
Okay.
Standing Rock right now.
Yep.
You know, sadly, it's being cleared and burned down as we speak. It's awful, sad situation. Now, if people understood, whether it was people who solely looked at the mainstream media, but even forget that. I mean, people who are just on their Facebook groups or Breitbart watchers understood why people are protesting there on a much more cultural level, I believe there would be a humanity that emerges where more people would probably find some compromises with one another. Because a lot of those Native Americans and people there in solidarity are there because they believe in their belief systems that seven generations of their descendants are going to be affected by contaminated water. So it's not this struggle over land, right? That's a very Western framing of the issue. It's like kind of a property rights issue.
And it's not just the environmentalism aspect.
No.
It's also like a personal affront.
Family threads, right? It's not, it's so like that, like neither of us have really, I think, like seen much of that. So this is what I mean. It's like we need an internet that better explains that, so the sort of, it's subtle, but it's actually extremely powerful. Because when I found out about that, which was difficult for me to find in lots of ways, when I found out about that, it made so much sense to me why people are so engaged in this. It's not the kind of Western environmentalist. It's not a Greenpeace thing. It's not a, you know, fight over land. They understand that their land was taken from them. They're not trying to reclaim the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They just want sovereignty. And when they say sovereignty, it's not over their land. It's over their cultural values.
And a lot of, I think, the eye rolls that you do see over Standing Rock, kind of the flooded exhaustion of the news over Standing Rock, especially, I think, for liberals on Facebook, where it is like fire hose to them. It's a common theme that
right.
they're seeing in their thread, is that they are equating this like kind of white fight. Mm-hmm. Like it's, oh, these like privileged white liberals are going to stand
Shailene
with Standing
Woodley,
Rock.
For
exactly.
Example.
And yeah. they're thinking, this is like a Greenpeace kind of a thing.
Right.
It is just like a crunchy hippie granola thing. Like, oh, these poor people will go and we'll help them.
Sure.
And that's so not the right approach. But the problem is middle-aged white men write the news by and large.
Right.
Right. Obviously, we have ethnic minority journalists and we have female journalists. But as you go up the chain, just like with any corporation.
Right.
The editorial staff becomes more and more homogenized. The board
Absolutely.
Becomes more and more homogenized. And really, the only way to change, quote unquote, like when you said it'd be great to have a better internet. Mm-hmm. It's the internet really is the wild, wild west. And a lot of people like that about the internet. Like we don't want to see the internet becoming kind of manipulated in any sort of way, like, and who's in charge of that? If it's the government, then you have like massive First Amendment issues. So the only real way to do that is to have more of the small voices brought up to the surface, right?
Absolutely. And you said it perfectly, Kara. It's just like the issue with who are our major editors and journalists. The people that are creating these technologies tend to, even if they might be like Indians like myself or Chinese people like myself, they tend to follow the dictates of kind of a white, a middle-aged male perspective on things. So like there's some really good data out there and research out there that shows what happens when you look, for example, at black women on Google, right? And how that actually reinforces existing sexist and racist biases. Or there's a piece that showed up in the New York Times called AI's White Guy Problem, which shows how AI kinds of systems are actually kind of primed and configured. You know, when you kind of vet and kind of set up a system around some kind of corpus of data, they are configured around kind of white male perspectives and white male ways of thinking. So we have to kind of open up who participates in the design of technology. And that's a big part of the argument in my book, which is full of stories of me basically doing like the most fun stuff ever, which is like hanging out with communities all over the world and like hacking things and making things and designing technologies and seeing how smart activists are actually thinking about technology in ways that defy this sort of simple narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Is that example of the New York Times article that you mentioned, was that the example in or was that piece covering the example in which the AI algorithms that were looking for visual categorization were literally misconstruing like apes as African American men?
That it's related to that exact research.
I mean, that is such an egregious example. And of course that was the news hook, right? That's what a lot of people remembered because if it's that wrong about something so obvious, what are all of the other nuanced, pernicious things that you don't even know are there?
All over the place. And what could be really interesting is, what if, you know, the perspective of a person of color or a woman of color could actually inform the ways an algorithm could be defined or designed, right? Again, these technologies are just created by people, right? Like everything from the interfaces we design on a very front-end level to the ways we decide to model data and data modeling to the ways we choose to do like calculations through data, which is an algorithm, right? It's a mathematical expression, right? So all of those are subject to certain ideas of like what their constraints are, what their parameters are, how much they shift, how open are they to like user-based modification. These are all just parts of a design process. And who is empowered to be in the design room is the key issue here. So I have these stories in my book of like what happens when a group of Native Americans design their own communication system. What happens when a group of Egyptian activists decide to think about how they're going to use social media in the context of the Arab Spring, you know, which, you know, everybody should still remember.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's like definitely in our recent memory. And that's really where the title of the book comes from, right? Whose Global Village? We talk about globalization. Maybe I shouldn't say globalization because that has a lot of the economic implications. But when we talk about this like bright and shiny future where it's so much easier for people to get information and everyone has a cell phone and, you know, a class in an African village who doesn't have clean water is still able to get online and watch PewDiePie be anti-Semitic on YouTube. You know, it's like we're all connected, but like that who's global bill. Like, what is the overarching theme that people are, what are we learning once we all get connected? Because still the architects have a very specific, and this is not conspiratorial thinking. It's not there's a room somewhere and there's a mustache twisting and there's a specific agenda. This is all bias. This is all cognitive, you know, problematic thinking. These are human, very natural things that we do when we're not willing to basically be skeptics and get out in front of all of our kind of human biases and try and nip them in the bud before they take over a system.
I mean, ain't that the truth? It's really about what happens when a local group of people builds a platform that served and supported their purposes, but then that platform expands to 1.8 billion people in the world, right?
Remember,
Facebook was a Harvard community network. Now, it's not exactly the same thing as it was then. Mm-hmm.
But started with white,
it was a Harvard community
kids.
Network. Yeah. It was a bunch of students at Harvard, you know, and some were white, some not, but it was a Harvard thing, right? It was a community. Totally.
And all of the architects were white. Like the not all, but the early, I know what I know about Facebook from watching The Social Network, which I assume is a documentary. But the brothers and, you know, Zuckerberg and all of these kind of what we think of. And that's not to say that this isn't important to Mark Zuckerberg. And that's not to say that he is not fully aware that this is a real issue. And maybe this is a runaway problem.
He gave that manifesto this last week where he said that we need to be more involved in supporting global communications. But again, just like the Global Village, what does he mean by global communications? Whose voices are included and excluded from that conversation, right? When you have 1.8 billion users and you started as a community network, something's not going to cohere at that moment, right? And there's going to have to be a lot of invisibility when we scale things out. So what they need is a much more dynamic and adaptive way of responding to different user communities. They need mechanisms of giving us different options over the different types of algorithms that govern and shape our digital experiences. They need to serve the public. And especially in the United States, they have to recognize that they are the face of news. They are the face of journalism. They are basically the journalistic network, even if they don't produce much of the news themselves.
Yeah, and like it or not, that's the case. As much as you can say, well, we don't try to do that, and that's not our intention.
You know why you guys are worth billions and billions and billions of dollars? It's because you guys were able to succeed on this level. So now you have to figure out what values you serve.
Yeah, you control the narrative, and you are incredibly exciting to advertisers for that reason. It's funny because this is one of those prime examples, I think, of just why it's so, I mean, why I think education obviously is one of the most fundamental values that I hold and that I thought our country held, you know, it's always so important not to reinvent the wheel. We always talk about how history repeats itself and we can learn so much from the past. We like to throw around terms like democratization. It's such an edgy kind of term that you hear on TED Talks all the time, right? And when we think of democratization, we really, it is this idea of the global village, forgetting the who's for a second, but right. Just the global, oh, things are democratized. As technology improves, things are democratized. But then we think about our own democracy, which is really a representative democracy. That's and right. It's really a republic. And when you start to dig into it, there was a long time where, you know, black people were 3/5 of a person. There was a long time where ethnic minorities and women couldn't even participate in the democracy. Sure. And even now, it's not really the people whose voice. I mean, we have a president that was elected who lost the popular vote because we have this group of electors that actually fully have the outcome on lock. And all of a sudden, you start to realize, like, democratization is on a spectrum.
Anytime you create this kind of notion of a global village or this kind of master model of like what you're supposed to govern.
One person, one
voice. There are social contracts that go into that. And, yep. You know, and then there's, and you can't understand any platform, whether it's the platform of American representative democracy or what might now be increasingly an oligarchy, or the platform of the internet without looking at how it's governed, who writes its codes, who monetizes it, who profits from it. And so, you know, the internet is absolutely transcendently incredible, mm-hmm. but it is the infrastructure and the form of technology that has had the greatest promise for humans, because we have, in theory, the opportunity to send and receive information, to be in two-way conversations with almost anybody anywhere, and that is powerful and profound. But if those conversations are not actually truly our own as its users, if those conversations follow the same model that, you know, older media followed, right, where it became like Viacom and Disney and Rupert Murdoch and all this stuff, then we are losing what it could be.
Yeah, you know, and this is not a hindsight conversation we're having here. It's right still now. Early. It's still fresh. We could still be putting checks and balances and methods and engineering into place that secures a fair future. And that's something that, at least here in the United States, and I think I could probably argue to say globally as a whole, just people aren't that good at. We're just not that good at foresight. We're not that good at trying to think about how the decisions that we make today are going to affect us generations down the line. Sure. Native Americans, maybe.
Sure.
Maybe that is like exactly one of the pages that we need to be taking
to
out
pay attention
of
to.
This book, because, I mean, Lord knows we could learn a lot from these groups who really do think about multi-generations in the future.
We always have had this as humans, like throughout our history, we've always had like a recency bias, mm-hmm. in the sense that like whatever is newest and hippest and coolest because it's newest is that which we see as, you know, almost universal, or definitely that as most that which is most, you know, sort of evolved, if you will.
Yeah,
and so that and so like that actually that kind of ahistoricizes how we think about science and technology, and this is something that I think we need to confront in certain ways. And I really believe that there's so much possibilities for thinking about innovation around these lines, these political lines, these cultural lines. It can happen, but we have to start by looking at some real truths about what the digital revolution has actually created for us. I mean, you know, the internet was like this, you know, when you have a beautiful little infant and then you realize that infant is an adolescent and the adolescent has been maybe traumatized by something that's happened at school. You know, I don't know if it's the best of metaphors, but I see this point right now, mm-hmm. as sort of similar to that. And I think we have to think about technologies, it's, you know, we almost have to think of that classic anthropological perspective, which is like, these are tools, these are forms of communication. So how do we think about those tools? Who creates those tools? Who owns those tools?
And
who writes the code?
It does require some deep philosophical thinking. You know, it requires some real thinking about ethics and about logic that in many ways underlie a lot of the greatest pressing issues of humanity. The problems with climate change, the issues with pollution, the issues with overpopulation. A lot of these things really do come down to basic ethical judgments about the future and about stewardship that we oftentimes want to kind of just put to the side, and we don't want to have those conversations, and we can deal with that stuff, is too core, it's too fundamental, we're always going to agree to disagree, so let's now build a system that will allow for the most positive, from a value judgment perspective, the most positive outcome possible. But we're ignoring all of the thinking that is required to develop what those value judgments are. And it's funny to me when I do this show on Talk Nerdy and I have people on from all walks of life doing all different work, there's these themes that just keep coming back. It could be somebody who's, you know, working on information technology and design, or it could be somebody who is working on ocean conservation. Absolutely. And I see very similar themes.
Absolutely. And it's the idea that, like, when we think about systems like scientific or technological ones, we have to remember that those are always cultural.
Yeah.
Right. And so, like, part of the reason why Native Americans or indigenous peoples more generally are on the front lines of fighting climate change, it's not because they are exactly the same as environmental scientists. It's because their experiences of climate change, which is real, is very material. Like, it's affecting, like, the waters around them, right? It's why the Maldives held an underwater news conference. Remember that at the climate conference? So so I think the more we humanize these experiences by sharing people's stories, insofar as they are appropriate to be shared, insofar as people are open to sharing them, that's a different kind of global village. It's a global village that is respectful of the sovereignty of diverse cultural voices. It rethinks the internet in relation to that and the platforms that come to populate the internet. And it shifts away from a kind of top-down model to something that's much more grassroots. And I do believe that companies and businesses can be allies in this movement. I do believe that Facebook can continue to be a multi-billion-dollar company as allies in this movement.
Oh, yeah. And I don't even see this as something that will necessarily take money from them. It could actually be lucrative for them if they approach it the right way. So I have some questions specifically about this idea of kind of coming at an approach to storytelling from a much more diverse and personal and multi-ethnic perspective. I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsor of today's episode. And as soon as we come back, we will have more with Ramesh Srinivasan. Well, I want to take a moment to thank Audible, the sponsor of this week's episode, and to remind you to take a moment to visit www.audible.com/try now, because you'll get a free audiobook with your 30-day trial. Now, I know you've heard me say it before, but Audible is just great, especially for nerds like us, because they have an unmatched selection of audiobooks available. That means that even if you can't physically be reading because you get car sick on the subway, or because you're driving, or you're working out, you can still get your reading fix in. And Audible has the best selection out there. So why not visit and download a book by, you know, one of the guests that we've had recently on Talk Nerdy, like Maya Salovitz's Unbroken Brain? Or how about, let's see, Maria Konnikova's The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. You could also listen to a book by Simon Singh. He has quite a few, The Code Book, The Simpsons and Their Mathematical Secrets. Or Lydia Pine's Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils. And let's not forget Deva Sobel's The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. There's so many great books for you guys to choose from. So what are you waiting for? Visit www.audible.com/try now, and you'll get a free audiobook with your 30-day trial. That's www.audible.com/trynow, TRYNOW. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, we are back with Ramesh Srinivasan, the author of Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. And we were just kind of talking about a new approach to storytelling and a new approach to, I guess, information, which is one that really is inclusive of voices that aren't generally in the main conversation. And that's not because those voices aren't dominant, and it's not because those voices aren't loud and proud. It's mostly because of who really has the reins. It's who's got the purse strings, all that, you know, it's always been the case.
Yes.
Who's in control, who's in charge, that narrative generally set, even if it's not intentional, even yes. if it's, you know, there's nothing pernicious about it. So the question is, sometimes when we hear a story from a faraway culture, a faraway land, in our minds, a culture that really, or an individual that really is part of the global village or should be part of the global village, but we might have difficulty empathizing because we don't have the same kind of fundamental knowledge. Do you think then that it's really important to have these sort of cultural translators that are available and to have these individuals who have been on both sides of the aisle and sort of know how to make these stories a little more palatable for a Western world or an Eastern world, for example, so we don't just deepen the divide by telling core stories?
I really love that question, and that's actually one of the big questions that comes up in my book. Mm-hmm. I believe as much as possible, it's important to err on the side of learning from other people in as raw, if you will, or open a forum as possible. However, it can't be in a way that is completely, you know, decontextualized from who we are. So, like, I'll give this as an example. If I want to learn Mandarin or if I want to learn an Aboriginal language, I don't learn that language simply by looking at an English dictionary of Mandarin. It simply won't work because the very basic structure of the language, the very basic semantics of that language or that other tradition, it's not a one-to-one relationship. It just can't be. So I do have some cognitive frames in my mind that allow me to empathize. Mm-hmm. I do have mechanisms within me that are all that are shared with all humans, right? Like my connections, every human is notable for his or her connections to other humans and his or her connections to land and the elements, if you will. So somehow we have to tell stories that privilege the authenticity of those stories as they are in this global village, but in a way that almost primes us to kind of experience the otherness for what it is without the otherness being unfamiliar. So that point of familiarity is really, really powerful. But if you simply, I tell the story in the book of this really interesting moment where a group of environmental scientists in Australia go to this Aboriginal community to try to learn from the community about how it takes care of the land by burning the land so that more can regrow. So you burn,
like it's
prescribed burns. Mm-hmm. That's what they call it. And so they go there, and these Aboriginals do all these rituals. They're walking, they're singing, and then they're also doing these burns. And the environmental scientists try to do the exact same thing. It's kind of magic here. Try to do the exact same thing as those Aboriginal people with the burns, but they don't do any of the rituals or any of the walking or any of the singing and any of the visiting of these families, and the burning just doesn't work. And it's partly because they were trying to filter the other tradition through their own lens. And I'm sure there's a scientific way of explaining why you can't replicate the practice without doing the same things, but it's interesting to know sometimes the rituals and the kind of rawness of culture actually helps us achieve a lot of wonderful outcomes in our life. And it's important for me to point out, I'm not some kind of cultural traditionalist. I'm not saying that like culture is pure or immaculate. Culture itself is always changing, just like our languages are always changing. It's just, we're at a moment right now where there's a vanishing of biodiversity on our planet.
Absolutely.
And linguistic and cultural diversity. And the vanishing of linguistic and cultural diversity is correlated to the vanishing of biodiversity because we are animals, right? Mm-hmm. Like as humans, we're animals. So when this is being lost, what is being lost? Well, in my opinion, part of what's happening is these language encodes different cultures. This is what Jared Diamond says, right? Like from UCLA. If we don't develop global villages, so to speak, or internet networks that support that really fundamental radical diversity, it's going to be part of the problem. It's going to be part of the problem. So like homogenization, globalization are all ways of flattening the world. That's everything that this book is trying to argue the internet should not do.
Interesting. So then what you end up with is this need for a balance between keeping things heterogeneous and ensuring that you have these individual global populations, but at the same time, not creating such intense echo chambers that you can't interact and communicate.
Exactly. My argument is we should never be in total fragmentation either. It's just about learning from other people, like on their terms that they feel is respectful. Like, so the book is like this book, Who's Global Village, right? And my book is full of stories from chapters 3, 4, and 5, where I'm like working with these Native American communities. And I'm wondering, like, I have National Science Foundation funding. And I'm wondering, like, when are things going to get done on my like research time schedule? And they just don't happen that way. Yet everything happens. And everything happens just because I start to get comfortable. It takes me a long time. I start to get into that place where I can just be comfortable with sitting and being and letting things happen with these people on their own terms in whatever way it happens.
Interesting. It's funny because as a real scientific thinker or somebody who strives to be as much of a scientific thinker as possible, the one thing that kind of makes me like, when we were talking, is this conversation about the Aboriginals and the burning kind of tradition. And it makes me just want to know, like, there must be, like you said, you even think there must be something scientific in there, in the ritual that the scientists either couldn't put their finger on, there weren't. So when they tried to replicate it by completely divorcing what they thought of as the fundamental kind of procedural portion from what they thought of as like the mystical bullshit portion, then it didn't work. So it must be that something that they saw as being like the bullshitty stuff still had something necessary in it that really ultimately would be scientifically, you know, provable.
And science can be respectful of culture by actually being inclusive to culture.
It needs to be.
Because science, much like culture, is not unitary. It's not homogenous. Science is always changing. You know, there are paradigms that shape and change science. Think about the massive transformations in science itself over its history.
But the scientific world has the exact same problems that we're talking about here, where it's historically been a lot of white men who are making the decisions. And with that, you see that even though you're interrogating nature and you're, you know, coming up with these brilliant questions and then able to come up with answers, the lens that you're doing it through, when it's incredibly biased, only gives you a little bit of information. It leaves out a lot of the individual differences of people who weren't included in the studies, or it leaves out fundamental questions that nobody thought to ask because there were no women on the panel, for example, or nobody that wasn't like Anglo-Saxon on the panel. So that is also an important thing to remember, that even though science as a practice we often think of as like the truest or the most reproducible and valid method to find quote-unquote truth, it's still done by people.
And what sociologists and philosophers of science have argued, also the way they speak about technology, is what happens is because part of what travels really well with science is like F equals MA, right? Like, so like laws. Oh,
yeah, physics is very like kind of materialist.
You can kind of precisely, like you can kind of modularly like kind of grab a component of it and then like disseminate it. But actually, what all the kinds of practices and conditions and kinds of specificities that went into constructing F equals MA, it's harder for that to travel because it's such a local process. But that's actually the fundamentally scientific process rather than the F equals MA, right? The F equals MA is just a state condition. It's a way of kind of like describing
a something that already exists, right? It's just a linguistic kind of symbolic interaction, like label on top of it. And the problem too is that we're culturally bound by these descriptions of discovery. So even though oftentimes in the general public the process is divorced from the information, which is a huge bummer because it's really the process that matters. Right. Even within the scientific community, the process becomes divorced. And when we do understand the process, when we focus on the history and systems of a certain discipline, unfortunately, it's usually monolithic. It's like one dude figured this out. It's like,
yeah, those
people
are just
from
stories.
A lot of different cultures figured this out. They just didn't write it down the same way that. And we completely ignore things like. I posted a story the other day online about basically like, let's not forget that algebra is like a Middle Eastern invention. You know, let's not forget.
An algorithm is Persian mathematics.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's not forget about the incredible light periods in the history of parts of the world that we want to just shun and say are backward. And it's like, no, a lot of what we fundamentally, like the numbers we use are Arab numbers.
Absolutely. And for example, if you look at like sand divination systems in West Africa, mm-hmm. so these are called religious and cosmological, almost magic systems, they follow incredible mathematical processes of recursive logic and also of fractal logic. Mm-hmm. And my colleague Ron Eglesh has given some talks about that.
It's so interesting how we can, you know, the context may change, but there are fundamental truths that we find that are so not culturally bound. They're that every culture smiles. You know, every culture laughs. We've never been able to find one where that's so human. It doesn't even, we're all the same species. That said, do you get pushback, especially from individuals with this more kind of materialistic viewpoint? Do you ever hear people say kind of, your perspective is so postmodern, your perspective is so kind of culturally relativist, and that can also be dangerous in its own right.
Sure. I mean, it's a question I get all the time. It's because my work starts with the respect and dignity of diverse people and communities and diverse publics, whether we mean someone living in a neighborhood in Los Angeles or we mean a Native American. They're all to me the same because mm-hmm. they are communities. And it actually moves out of the kind of Western framing, which is like the individual in relation to the state or the superstructure. It's like Western liberal framing. Yeah. So because it can do that, and right, and a lot of anthropological work can do that. But my work, because I'm a designer and because my aim is the internet, is actually much larger in scale. Because my work is about here are these things one can learn in a very intentional way by thinking about design, by thinking about new technology, by thinking about how technologies are used by communities of people and telling those stories. Now, how can that influence the ways platforms are designed? How can that influence the ways in which people can have larger scale conversations that still respect the legitimacy of their local conversations? Mm-hmm. So there is some technical aspects to the book where I talk about different ways in which different communities model databases and model information and even model algorithms and how they can actually meet one another in this way. So there's a little bit of a tension of the top down and bottom up, definitely. But I think that the kind of bottom up part of the book is always acknowledging some fundamental universals like human rights, like environmental rights, like the dignity and sovereignty of people and communities, the rights of women. You know, these kinds of issues are so important as well.
And what do you do? I mean, it's kind of an unfair question, right? It's the same question that you get a climate scientist who's speaking in front of a big group of people or, you know, just a well-respected scientist who comes to a university and they give a big talk and then somebody stands up and says, like, what do you do about people who don't even think the earth is round? You know, you have these kind of fundamental pushbacks. So there's an assumption that underlies a lot of your work, which is that individuals are valuable. Right, or that we don't have parity, and because we don't have parity, voices that are sometimes quieted need to be elevated. Yet there's a huge movement that I'm seeing is emboldened lately in the United States. Just for us having this conversation, I can assure you that I will get feedback from people who will use labels like social justice warrior. From people who will talk about the fact that, you know, it's kind of that argument of everyone has the same opportunities. And so if you are whining about women's rights or you are whining about, you know, the rights for ethnic minorities, it's just because you didn't get your way. Like, I'm seeing this argument more and more, this kind of rewriting of history or this, again, this non-fact-based narrative that somehow, because we live in America, there's parity.
Sure. I mean, we know that. First of all, we know that's not the case, right? There's plenty of data that shows that we have massive amounts of income inequality, and that those forms of inequality are even higher when they're applied to like Black and Brown and mm-hmm. women, right? So like we know that, like maybe you and I know that, but here's what I would say. I totally get that. And I also think that the mechanisms by which these sorts of like these, if I guess I'd have to say like these sorts of discourses or stories are produced and shaped and circulated has everything to do with what's happened with social media. And that's kind of the point I was making earlier. Mm-hmm. But I do think we need to break out of those. And I think we need to understand, I think when people start having open, more open conversations with one another, and we try to just sort of hear what might be behind those claims, what's behind those claims? What's behind the curtain? Like what's, you know, when the Wizard of Oz is behind the curtain, right? It's just a little guy.
Yeah.
It's like that is actually, I think, what's happening. So I think what's behind the curtain is a feeling that, you know, these people maybe were not treated justly, but I wasn't either.
Yeah.
Right?
That's true.
And so like recognizing that those people were also not treated in a just way, which is a very like fundamentally psychological and almost emotional level, an empathic space. I think that that's the way we have to go. And we need to develop it. We are so far off what we need in terms of developing tools that allow us to communicate with one another in more empathic ways. And maybe I sound like a total hippie saying this, but it's like, it's where we need to go. And I do think it can start by figuring out ways for platforms like Facebook to start to open us up to different voices in different ways. Because the internet troll phenomena, from Milo to Trump himself, mm-hmm. I think that both internet trolls, functions really well in this fragmented media environment.
It does. And I think it's so important hearing you say that as, might I say, a brown American, yeah. because we see it on both sides of the aisle, you know? We see a conversation where a quote-unquote men's rights activist, a white internet troll might be like, oh, you're just crying. You know, I wore a t-shirt on election day that said the future is female. And then I was very sad when
sure.
Hillary was not elected. Sure. And then I got so much hate on my, it was, I think I posted on election night. It was a very emotional time for many, many people. I posted basically like a crying emoji, and I got so much hate from individuals, you know, oh, she didn't get her way. Oh, why did you think she would get elected just because she has a vagina? You know, whatever the rhetoric is. But what you also see a lot of times when you have somebody who's a tone-deaf white person who's complaining about how they were treated unfairly, just like you said, who doesn't understand systemic racism, who doesn't, you know, yeah. who just hasn't been outside of their own bubble to see these things, yeah. it doesn't help when then you have a community of minorities backlashing at them, saying, sure. you're a dumb white person who doesn't know what it means to be, you know, pained. It's like, you don't know. Maybe she experienced horrible abuse as a child. You know,
absolutely. Many disenfranchised working class white people.
Yeah,
in
so
this
it's
country.
Kind of like, and I'm not comparing by any stretch, because there is a difference between sort of what we think of as institutionalized racism and systemic racism or inequality and individual pain and suffering. And it's, I think the first thing we have to do is stop comparing our pain to everybody else's
Precisely.
Pain.
Precisely. And I think there are certain issues that can bring disaffected peoples from the left or the right, if you will, all together, right? And I do think that Trump really cleverly exploited that or took advantage of that space, which also Bernie Sanders did, right? And
Absolutely. It's
so interesting to see that why would there be overlap between those two?
But there were a lot of Bernie voters that voted for Trump because they both had this anti-establishment, anti-Hillary stands for everything that, you know, we want to burn the White House was one of their slogans.
Yeah.
It was blow up the system and start from scratch.
Yeah.
And that scared
me. It's unfortunate.
It scared me a lot. Yeah. This kind of not very pragmatic view, this sort of idealistic, you've got to always have balance there. And again, I think it comes down to kind of like low information for a lot of, and that's not to say I have plenty of Bernie supporters that are listening, and I probably have plenty of Trump supporters that are listening.
Sure.
And I'm not putting everybody in the same box. There are many brilliant things that Bernie stood for that I loved about him. I wish he would have been Hillary's running mate. oh sure. my God, it sure. would have been such a better sure. ticket. And there are probably many, many things. It's harder for me to point to them, but many things that Trump supporters see as solutions to their own disenfranchisement. So that's not to say that everybody who supports these individuals, they're not monolithic. There's no way I could look at three candidates and be like, you perfectly embody everything I stand for. It
no,
work
and
that
we should just realize that people in this country sadly are divided, but the forces that did that division are not right-wing Tea Party people, and it's not leftists either. It is these kind of institutional forces that kind of shaped a climate where a lot of inequality was developed. And so people in those situations sometimes start blaming one another. But I think what we need are media, and I mean new technologies, mm-hmm. Including Facebook, that help bring us together to understand areas of common agreement so we can start to build those empathic conversations, start to understand one another's cultural and political differences. Now, it's hard to imagine what that would look like right now, but I do believe it can happen. And I think we can start by simply visualizing and figuring out ways with a little more depth to understand why someone would post what they would post if something they posted seemed offensive.
Yeah.
What's behind that? Like, what's behind that? Like, can we show more? Is there a way to show more? Because I really don't believe... I think a very small percent of people in this world and definitely in this country are just pure evil. I really don't. I think we're just complex human beings.
Absolutely.
We blame things. We have lots of different cultural forces. And I do feel that we have to start by finding points of agreement. And you know what? Other stuff starts to thaw at that point.
It's important to understand motivation. Because I do think there's a difference between something that Milo says and something that somebody who was reading Milo retweets.
Right.
There's a big difference because there are architects, and
yes.
we have to remember that too. Sometimes we forget that there are movements that were crafted, you know, that where individuals are doing it purely for financial gain, or they're doing it purely for political prominence. And once we start to understand the motivation behind the decisions that are made and behind the rhetoric that's spewed, yeah. I think we can develop a better critical skill for, you know, is that somebody who's attempting to find truth, or is that somebody who's trying to convince me to do something because they will gain from it, but
right.
I won't.
Right.
You know, it's really frustrating when you see people kind of what we call voting against their own interests. Because it's like, from the outside, you can sit there and be like, God, that person was duped.
Yeah.
I really think most of Trump's supporters were duped.
Well, we can see that right now, right? With who ended up populating the cabinet mm-hmm. and the advising role. So it wasn't draining the swamp at all. And,
yeah.
you know, I mean, that's it. Give him credit for running a brilliant political campaign. But now it's time more than ever. It's especially time in my mind for these internet giants to start to understand and acknowledge their political role, their journalistic role, and their cultural role. And it's like, it can't just be business as usual any longer, right? I mean,
yeah.
otherwise we are just fracturing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I have two questions I want to ask before
Great.
I ask more questions. And I don't want to forget them. So the second one is about fake news. So let's come
sure.
back to fake news in a second.
Sure.
But before that, do you think it's an oversimplification of somebody like myself who absolutely thinks this way? And we tend to make things binary and we tend to simplify things just so that we aren't drowning in nuance. Because it's tough. It's hard to always be a nuanced thinker. But when I basically... when I stand against pretty explicitly and denounce tribalism and nationalism, like those two words to me stand for things that are never good. But it does seem like there is something about tribalism that directly feeds to these kind of individual villages, right? It's funny because a big part of your angle is to kind of work against homogenization. And doesn't that require some amount of tribalism?
Absolutely. I mean, why don't we replace the word tribalism with diversity? Mm. And so let's talk about that. Yes,
yeah.
there are concerns that I have with nationalism that comes at the cost of understanding, loving, and learning from others, right? So, you know, and a nation itself is a highly arbitrary construct.
Absolutely.
How old is this nation? There's so many nations in the world that are even younger than this
And there's so many
than
nations that have been different iterations and vacillate
throughout the years. Look at places, for example, in colonized parts of Africa where national boundaries were drawn between tribal lines, and that's what's accounted for a number of different ethnic wars. And like you can see that in Sudan, South Sudan, you can see that in the history of Rwanda, etc. So no, there's an arbitrariness to nations. It's an imaginary. And it's interesting that you use the word tribalism. It's a good question, and it's a tough question. I don't think I ever claim that that's what I'm going for, per se, because that word tends to connote an idea of everybody fragmenting into their kind of existing micro kind of cultural identities at the cost of larger conversations with
another. It implies a nationalistic vibe, like kind of an in-group, out-group, and an inability to look beyond those borders.
Right. And I don't believe, and I don't argue for that last part to occur, but I do believe that there is an incredibly important space that needs to be recovered and thought about and placed at the forefront of our minds about thinking, quote-unquote, locally. And I don't, locally doesn't have to mean in a place, it could mean online. Mm-hmm. And so what I mean is that there are these, when we say we're part of a culture or part of a community, there are codes of conduct that are part of that community. It could be language, it could be values, it could be, you know, our performances, our practices. I want those things to be supported by our online systems. And because I believe that in those sorts of practices are part of what makes us diverse. It's part of why we have different approaches toward different issues, different approaches to solving different problems. I do believe that, like, when we lose these forms of diversity, our world will be poorer as a result. Mm-hmm. So I think the idea is I don't want to engineer globalization. I don't want to engineer the global village. That's the part of it that I have problems with.
I see.
I want to start by thinking about how tools and systems might be designed or appropriated, or we can open up platforms so that communication systems can occur within communities so that they can better communicate with the larger world from a position of strength and solidarity and connectiveness. Like, I'll give you an example. There's a lot of cool stuff happening around open source software in the world. And I think it's really interesting to see examples. My current project, my field work, is in the Oaxaca region in Mexico. And it's with several dozen Zapotec and Mixtec indigenous communities that are living all around Oaxaca. They haven't been provided cell phone service because the cell phone companies don't think it's worth the investment. So they're screwed over, basically, in a nutshell. So these guys are like, look, we need cell phones. We speak our language through cell phones. I mean, we speak our language orally is what I was trying to say. They have community radio stations. But we also need these cell phones so we can organize our economic activities, figure out how to sell stuff. So there is sort of an external aspect.
Well, I can't imagine living without a cell phone. Of course we need cell phones.
Yeah, like, and so they don't have. So there's this disenfranchisement. So they basically, with the help of some activists, they built their own cell phone towers.
That's awesome.
And they collectively own it. They speak Zapotec in those. They call one another across all those communities for free. And they can call their relatives here in Los Angeles, because there's a lot of people from that part of Mexico here in LA. They're calling them by tethering their local networks to voice over IP, and they're able, basically Skyping people. So they're able to make these phone calls at 1% of the cost that they were going to be exorbitantly charged before. So that's kind of what I mean by, like, thinking about a local network.
Yeah,
thinking
about a local. They built it from the ground up with their own perspectives in place. It wasn't some sort of, you know, what we think of as, like, not even like a colonial. But there is a bit of a tinge to that when we think of, like, a corporation swooping in and saying, here is this thing you get to have for a fee.
We're saving you with this access to technology.
It's even colonialist, like, within our own culture, you know, the big great Verizon or AT&T or whoever.
I'm not a big fan of any of them.
It's hard. Yeah, it's one of those things where we are forced to choose oftentimes, like, the lesser of many evils. Okay, so... So I wanted to ask you a little bit about fake news too before we end this. Oh my God, fascinating conversation, which we will have to continue in the future.
Of course, we will.
Yeah, this has obviously become what everybody's talking about. This idea of what is fake news? How do we control the idea of fake news? Where do these methods and approaches to trying to solve this problem bump up against the First Amendment? And beyond that, what the fuck, Trump, when he basically reversed the narrative, right? When we saw academics, journalists, individual activists started to see that there was a thread that was occurring, especially on the right. It happens on the left too, but this specific historical example, we'll say especially on the right, with outlets like Breitbart, we're saying, holy shit, they're reporting things that never happened and people are talking about them as if it were
Bowling
history.
Green.
Yeah, like these are things that didn't exist. Right. So then that occurs, and then somehow Trump, which has always sort of been his MO, you know, if he's being investigated for a sexual harassment situation, he will then try and point the sexual harassment thing about his opponent out. You know, it's like it's always been his MO to like flip the script. He's always known how to do that very well. So with fake news, we only recently, within the past few weeks, I really think maybe a couple of months, have started to see him turn and go, no, well, you're fake news.
Right.
Well, I'm not going to listen to you. You're fake news.
Right.
How the fuck, A, was he able to do that so seamlessly? And B, this like giant snowball that's rapidly falling down the hill. Like, how do we Sisyphus this shit back up there?
Yeah. I mean, the tech companies have to have some responsibility here. So basically, you can scream fake news. It's basically a mechanism of trying to delegitimate the other, right? That's all that is. You say that you don't count, your voice doesn't count. So I just keep saying, and this is what the CNN piece is about, that is a mechanism that's facilitated by how social media functions as the first point of entry that we have to news. So if you quickly dismiss a bunch of reporters or a bunch of stories, your supporters are going to be like, yes, they are out to get us. And we're going to keep recirculating those conversations on our Facebook walls.
Because that's all we're ever seeing.
That's all we ever see.
But if we're never seeing the other side who's also saying, no, this is fake news. Because eventually
and
when
they're
everything...
they're calling them fake news. So what does that mean? That means you basically can have 40%, which is enough to have a mandate in this country, especially because they control Congress, right?
Absolutely.
And that's all you need. I mean, this is a candidate who exploited division as a mechanism to be elected. The complete opposite of, at least on the symbolic level, of what Obama did. The exact opposite, right? On so many levels. So, it speaks to what's happened with the internet. It speaks to what's happened with social media. And, you know, it's not the cause of Facebook that this happened, but this was somebody who manipulated those network ecologies to take care of this. So when Trump says... a couple things that are important to note from that press conference. The leaks are real. The leaks are real, but the news is fake.
Yeah, you can't have it both ways, Trump.
Right?
Yeah.
So
because
your
it's
news
only
is fake.
It's only technically a violation and something that would be... what's the word I'm looking for? Something that you could legally prosecute if they're leaking actual... if they're leaking bullshit, it's not a leak.
And then he says, you know, you guys aren't so popular anymore. And he points to the media in the room. And then he said, and he goes, ... maybe I had something to do with that. And so see that? This is a mechanism of discrediting our media. And that mode of discrediting is actually really, really smartly timed because in polls, and he's correct about this, in polls before that were taken just a week or two before, the media in this country was seen as less truthful than Trump.
Yep.
So if 40% of people in this country believe that Trump is truthful, that's going to beat the media right now. Because what people see as truthful is that 40% of supporters he's going to get 100% hit rate with.
And you even had dumbasses like, what's his name from the House Science Committee, who's like the big climate denier?
Not Pruitt, you mean?
No, the guy who's been there for a really long time. Inhofe, maybe?
Oh, James Inhofe.
Yeah, who basically was like, you can't really trust any of the media. You should just get your news directly from Trump. Aside from the fact, because we're kind of ignoring the elephant in the room, which is like the word fascism. Like, aside from the fact that that is such an anti-democratic thing to do, it's so like just dramatically flies in the it's dictatorial, it's totalitarian, it's like one of the first chips that start to fall in that sort of structure. putting that on the shelf, which is don't put that on the shelf. Always keep that in the forefront of your mind.
Yeah.
It's also, it doesn't work unless you can keep that division really, really strict. Because
discreet. They have to be different worlds. And otherwise, you're going to lose that 40% and that's going to affect you at some point.
Yeah. If they're not different worlds, and then you all of a sudden on your social feed where you're seeing Breitbart and you're seeing and Fox News and you're seeing Trump say CNN's fake news, LA Times, New York Times is fake news. If you all of a sudden started to get everybody else's feeds where they were like, no, but like Breitbart is fake news. Yeah. And let me tell you why. It's not just that like now you have more information. More than anything, it's that if everything is fake news, then nothing is fake news.
That's right.
You water down the argument at that point.
That's
so
right.
This method of flipping the script and just throwing it right back at you is only effective in so much as you keep your core base totally separated.
And there are some techniques that Facebook can engage in to try to open this up. They could try to expose us to information outside of our friendship networks. They could try to like moderate what is and is not visible.
Mm-hmm.
There are these like fake news detection like technical projects underway right now.
Yeah, I saw a few places are starting to do that. I do...
But I think that's a little bit of a Band-Aid on the much larger issue.
I'm also a little afraid of it because I'm a little afraid that that's going to start bumping up against some First Amendment rights.
Precisely.
And to me, I'd rather protect the First Amendment than protect anybody's feelings.
Yeah.
And I would rather see a horrible, divided, you know, and nasty and at each other's throats constituency than a government or what we could say ostensibly or kind of not ostensibly, but in practice is a state kind of institution, something that's so big for its own britches that it might as well be the state, starting to bump up against the First Amendment in ways that are, I mean, because that right there is just as bad as trying as I, you're not a legal scholar. I'm not a legal scholar, but I'm definitely interested to see what the ramifications of keeping these large media entities out of a White House briefing actually is.
It's a bombshell today. And it,
to me, that seems like there is a case to – the ACLU is probably going to figure out how to file suit.
Yeah. So these dynamics that I'm writing about, both in the book as well as in this piece on CNN and the one on Quartz, are coming home to roost more and more and more.
Yeah.
So now it's time for new alliances to be formed, for us to take back the internet, for us to take back technology – and really recover this idea of the global village to actually support user communities in conversations with one another.
Have you been working on this book a long time? Or was it? Because the funny thing is, it's so like relevant. Yeah. Were there just certain examples you were able to put in towards the end that, because it's almost like it was written this month.
It's really incredible. And sadly, it's really timely on this level.
Mm-hmm.
And also so many of the ideas that are in the book, which come out of like sort of my own experiences and looking at the birth of the internet and how it's changed over the last 15 years. Remember, as a grad student at MIT, when Google was just being developed, we were developing all these platforms. My office mate was the founder of BuzzFeed.
Yeah.
Right. So, and he lives right here in this neighborhood. It's just like
cool.
This whole world changed right in front of my eyes. And we were all wondering what is happening. And so, with these dynamics that are happening right now, the problems and the issues with the internet and whose voices it represents have really come home to roost. And
so,
I'm really happy.
That's the thing. There's always scholars that have known these things were coming for a long time.
But
and
we need
to
you.
Listen to them.
We need you to like help us get our voices out, you know? And that's why I'm so grateful for you for having me here.
Oh my God. I'm so thrilled to have you on the show. I close the show with the same two questions. You said you listen to the show, so you probably already know what they are. So I'll just throw them at you. When you think about the future, I'm assuming you're going to be thinking about it from a global context, considering that you're writing the book about the global village, but they could be personal. Number one, what is the thing that you're most concerned about? We may know the answer to that question already. And on the flip side of that, what are you sort of the most optimistic, excited about, looking forward to?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very, very concerned about the vanishing of cultural and biodiversity in our world, because I really do believe that climate change is having huge effects that I think maybe those of us in the first world don't see, but a lot of people in the developing world are really being afflicted with. And it's not long before it comes and hits us here right in the face. So that's the one that really terrifies me. It's not this nonsensical stuff about the fight with ISIS or any of that stuff. I think of that as a very small scale. And I think those things can be reconciled. If we start to have those larger conversations, those guys in ISIS are going to be essentially kicked out of that area by the people from there itself. I'm most optimistic about what I also see because of the rise of right-wing fascism, essentially, in parts of the world. I'm incredibly heartened by seeing how liberals, progressives, activists, scholars, and just a lot of well-meaning people have come together and said, this is too far. So a
and
lot of
conservatives,
this,
some really and some strong conservatives. Conservatives.
I mean, I saw McCain on MSNBC. You probably saw that interview on Meet the Press last weekend saying, I don't really always like the media, but an adversarial media is good. And I think, wow, McCain would have been a much better thing for us right now. Than,
isn't it funny when you're like, I agree with McCain on a lot of things he's saying lately. Like, I still have fundamental disagreements, but what a good example of what a conservative party could be.
It could be.
Where the things we disagree about are real ideological differences
right.
and not fundamental values,
right.
you know?
And I do believe, I do have a lot of optimism that this sort of wave of media manipulating and social media manipulating fascism that is hateful is going to be swept out from under its feet.
Yeah.
I really do believe that because people are active and people aren't going to stand for this bullshit.
And also, there's a reason it's called progressivism. Progress moves forward, not backward. And history always tells us that we're moving towards progress. There may be dark times, there may be steps backward, but as a general trend, we're always trending in a progressive way.
And remember, like Steve Pinker's work, for example, that's talked about how there's been fewer murders and violence that are happening in our world. So it's just important to remember that. It's hard not to pay attention to the things that are wrong, but there's actually a lot more that's right. And the things that are wrong, we can overwhelm, you know, we can overcome.
And also, it is fake news when you hear Trump saying that there's more murders now than there were before. It's like even that argument.
Fake news is what supports and serves Trump because of the mechanisms by which media refract his commentary. It's clickbait.
It's true. And that is a great way to end the show this week. Well, Ramesh, thank you so much for being here. Your book, Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. Is it available now in the next few days?
It's literally available on February 28th onward. You can pre-order it on Amazon right now.
So you can go buy it right now. Go to Amazon. There's a link in the show notes so you can pick up the book and you can reach out to Ramesh and tell him what you think. You said you're kind of on Twitter.
I am on Twitter.
Oh, you
like
are on
more
Twitter.
And more
okay,
actively,
great.
More and more actively, especially with this book's release. You can have conversations with me around it. We're going to do some stuff on Reddit as well.
Awesome.
So my Twitter handle is Ramesh, R-A-M-E-S-H, Media, M-E-D-I-A.
Perfect, yes. Perfect. So everyone, reach out. Tell him thanks. Thank you.
It's all my pleasure.
From me. And also thank you guys for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.
Thank you.